Hi there, and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years, and I'm fascinated by how the companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them, and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds, and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. In 2020, Neve Talon co-founded HerSport, a pioneering social enterprise dedicated to increasing visibility, participation, equality for girls and women in sport. Combining her background in business and marketing with a lifelong passion for sport, she recognized a significant gap in media coverage and role modeling for female athletes in Ireland. Rather than simply study the issue, she acted alongside Mohamed as her co-founder, building HerSport into a dynamic platform offering digital content, educational workshops, and community partnerships aimed at changing culture and retaining girls in sport. Under Neve's leadership, HerSport has grown its digital community significantly, expanded into schools and clubs with education programs, and forged collaborations with brands and organizations committed to driving gender equality in sport. She's been outspoken about the dropout rates of girls in sport and the need to amplify the female athlete voice. Neve, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I hope I got everything there.
You'll have to do introductions to me all the time.
I'd love to say I wrote it myself, but I didn't. Right, take me back to the start. What was the genesis of HerSport?
Yeah, I guess it's probably a culmination of a couple of things. You know, as you mentioned, like I have always been involved in sport, and I suppose somewhat uniquely as a young girl or teenage girl, always a sports fan as well. I think over the years, having left school and then went into college, and you know, looked around and realised that you know more and more friends were dropping into sport, so it was becoming more uncommon for girls to be you know still playing football or swimming or you know running, whatever it might be. And then I suppose I was studying business, and I have, I suppose, looked into the kind of marketing side of things as well. And then trying to really get an understanding as to like why girls and women were dropping out of sport. And then coupling that, I suppose, with being the sports fan and realising there was certainly a lack of media coverage there. So you had to go digging, you know, to try and find out the results for female athletes. And if you weren't in the sport, you didn't know about them and that kind of thing. It was very difficult to kind of find a hub where you could find out the results and performances of female athletes. So with that, I suppose I had a little bit of web design in my back pocket, and I suppose the understanding of social media and marketing. And I did a little bit of a stint in a publishing company as well to be able to pull all of those things together and to found HerSport. So I did nearly go down the route of a PhD, but I have to say I'm probably glad that I didn't. Not that it's off the cards for the future, but for now we've plenty to be doing. So,
And what would the PhD be in, as a matter of curiosity?
Yeah, see, that's the thing. Like when I was considering it initially, it was to try and you know get an understanding as to why girls and women were dropping out of sport. And essentially the supervisor of the PhD was like, well, you have to choose like one area to study and investigate. And I was like, well, it's not as simple as that. Like there's so many different reasons. So I suppose like why the marketing part is important for me was like looking around and understanding how are we marketing, you know, sport and fitness to girls and women. And, you know, this kind of picture perfect woman that hasn't got a hair out of place and is like never red faced and always in like matching outfits. And it's just not the reality of sport. Like go down to a camogie training session, they're covered in muck and battered and bruised and like not in matching outfits, I can tell you that much. And then go to the pool and like that's where I would have come from myself, and you know you're all red faced and you know it's not this you know perfect depiction of you know whatever people you know think that look is to be. So I think you know that was just like a curiosity for me, but then also realizing I suppose I have a bit of a thing like what does masculinity mean, what does femininity mean, and trying to understand that, like what has that, how does that kind of influence like stereotypes and that kind of thing as well. So a lot of like different things kind of pulled together for me to obviously start HerSport, but I think the PhD picking one area just didn't make sense. There were too many pieces to the puzzle.
It's a bit of a puzzle. What do you see as the mission of HerSport?
So our vision is equal opportunity in sport regardless of gender. Yeah. And what that means to us is that every girl, boy, man and woman has the opportunity to be involved in sport in whatever shape or form that looks like for them. So you obviously have people that are, you know, involved in sport at a club level and they want to, well, there's quite a range because some people want to be involved in social sport and then some people want to push themselves as far as they can go. And for some of those people, it might be something at provincial level. It might be a national championship. And then for others, obviously, it's right the way to the top to something like an Olympic Games, a Paralympic Games, World Cup, World Championships, that type of thing. So there is, I suppose, being involved in the athlete, whether it's somewhere on that spectrum between social and high performance. And then also involved as a coach, as a referee, to work in sport as well. So whether that's in broadcasting, whether that's in sports departments, like, you know, we talk about STEM and sport and there must be very, very, very few women that are involved in like in that crossover section. So all of the different like roles that you can be involved or ways you can be involved in sport, that the opportunities are there for girls, boys, men and women. A sports fan is actually something that we would talk a lot about as well. I think for a long time, you know, girls, women don't always feel included in that fandom space. In some sports more so than others. So it's about trying to create that change. We've done it, I suppose, we're trying to do it through the visibility work that we do. And I suppose in giving the media coverage, giving the visibility, also creating like open spaces for people to come down and be women's sports fans. So we have hosted watch parties like World Cup qualifiers. We would have hosted for the Women's World Cup in football, we would have hosted like watch parties to gather people together. And then also through education, because I think there's so much work to be done, you know, not just with like the kids and younger athletes, but also like parents, coaches and all the decision makers as well. So yeah, a lot in it.
Yeah. And do you think then the focus is much more on the amateur than the professional sport environment?
From our perspective? Yeah. I would say it's a combination of both. On one hand, like the media coverage, we do predominantly give the media coverage to high performance level athletes. So that is, you know, ensuring that they're getting the coverage that they deserve. When we started, 4% of sports media coverage in Ireland, but also across the globe, was going to female athletes. So I suppose there's a lot that comes with that as well, is like sponsorship opportunities. And in terms of like that goes for, you know, investments into teams and into clubs, international governing bodies, but then also into the athletes themselves. So if you think about it, like if I'm participating in whatever athletics and nobody has ever heard of me, I'm not going to be able to use my brand to then, you know, get sponsorship deals. Mm-hmm. Where if the media coverage changes and then more people are aware of who I am, then those opportunities are going to come forward. So that's, I suppose, how we're supporting and influencing them and giving them the exposure to get the support and to have that fandom as well. But in the same breath, I suppose, you know, looking at that, we're giving role models to not just young girls and boys, but like all the way up to the top, to, you know, people in their 80s and 90s that, you know, come to our community and see, you know, what the athletes and teams are doing and are exposed to that. And then on the education side, it's much more grassroots level. We do some work with high performance athletes and also with some national governing bodies, but it's much more at the local level to support clubs and athletes there.
Right, you came out of university, you could have gone the commercial or professional route within the marketing or business and things like that. So what drew you to set up a business on your own? Because that's like crazy stuff.
People kind of ask me, like, tell me about your career, and it would be on panels and stuff, and it kind of almost makes me laugh a little bit. Like, I did work as a marketing director in a hair salon for a little bit in the States, and then I've worked for a startup a little bit. My CV is not very long. I suppose I've probably always dabbled in different things. Like, you know, even if you go back to transition year and we did mini company and they looked around the table and they were like, well, who's supposed to be the MD here? And everyone's looking around and I was like, okay, I'll do it. So like in one way, I suppose I've always had the like ability and capability. And then I suppose other people also felt that I was the right fit at that time. I know we were only 16, but it started to show up there. And then I tried my hand at a couple of things, like made a website for, you know, booking babysitters. Myself and a couple of friends were going to do some babysitting, but like that was in secondary school. I was trying to do LinkedIn for makeup artists at some time. I suppose I've tried a few things, worked with startups, worked with like traditional businesses that are trying to go digital, you know, in their own way as well. And then both sides of my family do also have businesses as well.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So the apple hasn't fallen far from the tree in that regard.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I suppose in that way, like, that is probably, like, I never actually wanted to be a business owner, I would say, because I've seen how, like, tough it is. I was always, I suppose, under the impression and, you know, trying to self-evaluate and say, okay, you're probably going to end up in a leadership role somewhere. I'm, you know, quite comfortable with leading a team and working together and all of that kind of thing. But also was comfortable being, you know, under somebody else and, you know, these are the goals, these are objectives you have to buy into and you're going to lead this section of the business or something like that. But yeah, that hasn't happened yet. So I might maybe in the future at some point. I suppose, yeah, like from looking at maybe... like my dad and like the like work and graft that they would have had to put in for a long time. I know there's like not an ugliness, but there's a huge amount of difficulty with business as well. So I meet a lot of people and they're like, I'd love to have my own business. I'd love to do this. And I'm like, okay, well, like, what would you like? It's like, what would you like to do? I don't know. I just love to have my own business. And I'm like, okay, unless it's something you really, really, really want to do, you maybe want to think about like all of the, you know, things that maybe you don't enjoy doing that you're going to have to. So for some people, that's like accounting and finance. For some people, it's HR. Like there's a lot in it. So
it's a question I ask people all the time. You know, there is an awful lot of people like that, entrepreneurs who come in and don't realize all the hats they have to wear to get that, because it is them. Like, you don't have the HR department and the marketing department and this department. You are all of the above.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's all consuming almost.
Yeah, no, there's a huge amount in it. And, you know, I suppose the stage that we're at now, like we've, you know, 8 people on our team and we're starting to be able to, I suppose, apportion roles and responsibilities to like different people. And they're very clear on like what, you know, their job is. But there's always going to be stuff and still stuff for us where it doesn't quite sit under one person just yet. Mm-hmm. So everyone has to kind of row in together to like make sure that those things happen. So, you know, we do have merchandise as an example, but like not one person is really responsible for that. Like the whole team works together to keep that kind of ticking along. So that's obviously can be a bit more of a like fun aspect of the business than, you know, I suppose other things.
Doing the reporting accounts.
Yeah. Thankfully, Mohammed actually is a chartered accountant. So that certainly makes my life a bit easier.
That's always fine. Find someone better at the numbers. So what's more important, the sports or the sports person for you guys?
Go from what perspective?
Well, in terms of as you think about the mission and what you're trying to achieve, the sport presumably doesn't matter. It's about the sports person and their position in whatever sport they want to play.
Yeah, that would be it. Like we have been complimented like lots of times for the vast number of sports that we cover. I think when you look at, you know, lots of media outlets around the world, like they will have the 3 or 4 sports that they predominantly focus on. And I suppose from an Irish perspective, that can tend to be your Gaelic games, your rugby, your football. Athletics thinks they're a minority sport, but they get a lot of coverage over some of the others that really are
proper minority
sports. So it does depend on who you're talking to. But yeah, in that respect, like we really try and showcase as many sports as possible to show that like if you don't fit into those pitch sports or into athletics or into swimming or whatever it is, that there are options out there for you as an athlete, as a coach, in whatever role that is, as a sports fan. I'm sure some people come across like, you know, a random sport and they're like, wow, that's incredible. Like, I'm going to follow that around the world. But then also in terms of like how important it is to ensure that those minority athletes get coverage as well, because if you consistently give the same athletes in the same sports, the same, like most of the coverage all the time, that continues to give them opportunity and also not others. In 2024, we covered over 900 different female athletes. Do I know the number of sports? No, but I'll have that data for you for next year.
All Irish athletes?
Not all Irish athletes, but I would say like 90 to 95% of them must be Irish athletes. So like we do cover, you know, Simone Biles or Ilona Maher or Serena Williams or stuff that goes on in the UK. We have launched our Sport UK. I've been working on that, I suppose, probably for the last 18 months, but haven't quite had the opportunity to give it the resource that we would like it to. So the UK athletes would be kind of next closest to us.
Right, in time, how will you mark your own scorecard for success for her sport? Will it be participation? Will it be media coverage? Will it be prize money equivalents? What's the KPIs as you think about that awful word, I know?
We would have a couple of internal ones, I suppose. For us, we would have, I suppose, the phrasing of par. So to be on par with male counterparts. And for us, par means participation, attendance and recognition. So participation is trying to see that there's an increase of participation of female athletes in Ireland. I think it's 13% of female of young girls in Ireland are not meeting the recommended physical activity levels. I think it's versus 19% of boys. It's like not much better there, you have to admit. We have 1 in 5 girls dropping out of sport between primary school and secondary school versus 1 in 20 boys between primary school and secondary school. So obviously 4 times as many girls there as well. So participation is one aspect of it. For us, I suppose, when you really start to like dive into it, like we do want to see more participation of female coaches in different sports, then also in board level, in NGBs, you know, committees at local level as well. I think there's a huge amount of work to be done in clubs to have committees and coaching panels made up of more women for the voices in the room, but also for the role modelling visibility there as well. And then when it comes to the media coverage, you know, we have our own kind of goals annually of, you know, the growth targets that we want to hit. So we're expecting to be over 400,000 by the end of this year and to keep building and growing that. And as I said, like the UK is a big focus. Participation, I've gone off the media is actually into the recognition. The attendance is to try and support as many to support the growth of the fandom so that we do have a full Croke Park for the All-Ireland Ladies Gaelic Football Final, that we do have it for the Camogie Final, that the Aviva Stadium matches for the women's rugby and football are not unique things, that they become the norm and that the fans continue to show up. So there's quite an amount of work to be done, you know, there as an example. And then the recognition is that media coverage perspective. So yes, we have our own internal targets, but to be able to walk down the street and, you know, ask 20, 30, 40 people, you know, who's your favourite female athlete, or, you know, name 10 or 20 athletes, and that, you know, in and around half of it that comes back to you is female as well.
And again, it's the classic idea, if people don't see them, they'll never know them.
Yeah, exactly. Like that's a huge part of what we do is to try and change that. So, you know, somebody like Katie Taylor is obviously hugely recognised. Katie McCabe over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years has become a household name as well. When we would have started, Ciara McGeen and Ellen Keane would have been up there as there were kind of 5 female athletes that people could name. And also that the media covered, like they tended to just keep going to the same people all the time. I was like, that's not going to change anything. You need to start, like, there's unbelievable stories out there. You need to go out, talk to those people, find them, like showcase and share all those stories. And then that's like the broader, you know, stories you cover, the more that more people are going to find that they relate to somebody in that mix, and then get pulled into the sports community. So yeah, long way to go with that. But, you know, they're saying that in Europe, it's kind of between 10 and 15%. They're expecting that media coverage, it's between 10 and 15% of sports coverage is now going to female athletes. So not like it's an improvement, still a long way to go, but at least it's gone in the right direction.
And do you see yourselves having some sort of a lobbying role?
Yeah, we do. So we launched the Her Sport Foundation last year, to support us with doing that. You know, there's occasions where we would realise, like, unless our voice is in the room, some people aren't joining the dots, or they're not aware, or there's actually not consistent conversation about certain things, that, like, it's great to raise these things once, but unless somebody is raising them on multiple occasions, it's very easy to just kind of push it inside. Yeah, we talked about it once, or we had a campaign about it once, and we never did anything, you know, subsequent to that. So there definitely is, that's a little bit difficult to, like, you know, we have Her Sport as a business, identifies as a social enterprise, but some people kind of struggle to understand that. Social enterprise, there's a little bit of support in Ireland to get support if you're registered as a limited company as opposed to as a charity or a non-profit. So you'd be halfway through an application for a social enterprise and then be like, you know, what's your charity number? And we're like, well, that's not what we are. Yeah. So there was like a little bit of, you know, learning to do to try and figure out like where we fit there. So that's where the foundation came into play, to ensure that there was budget and resource to be able to go into lobbying and into different campaigns. They understand social enterprise, I suppose, a little bit more in the UK, and there's more kind of supports there, but it hasn't quite materialize in Ireland just yet. I know they are doing some work on it at the moment. So we launched the Her Sport Foundation. It's a non-profit at the moment. Will we go down the charity route? I'm not sure. We'll cross that bridge over the next couple of years and see. But it allows us to get either more support from grant funding or also from whether it's corporate organisations that really understand and what we're trying to do and are maybe a bit more comfortable with giving funds and resource to a non-profit over what technically is registered. Like the social enterprise, we're registered as a business.
Yeah.
So, no, that's great. Like we are a little bit over a year there. We have been involved in the National Women and Girls Strategy and involved in kind of a consultation there, and that strategy was launched about 2 weeks ago. So good to see that come forward and to see like the direction that goes. It's kind of a 5-year plan to ensure that the direction that we're moving is a positive one for girls and women in the country. It was a Monday morning when they did that consultation. I think I felt like my whole week's work had been done. I was like, it's a lot. Like it's a lot to feel that responsibility on your shoulders. That like things that we actually in the organization don't talk about every day, but when like we basically had like 7 or 8 different topics that were brought up, and there's representatives from like different organizations or different communities, and I would have put the sport lens on it for every topic, and so we would have got onto something like safety, and then I'm putting sport and safety together, and what actually comes out of a topic like that, I mean, it's a really tough conversation to be having, and to see the challenging positions or the different things that need to be, you know, put in place, that there's correct governance and protection for, you know, young female athletes, but also for adult female athletes as well. So I think it's really important that we're involved in those conversations and have the time to do them. One of the things is looking at like the resourcing in all the pitches around the country. So it's probably a little bit taken for granted sometimes to, you know, get changed on the side of the pitch or go pee in the bushes as a man. I think there's probably a lot of girls and women that would be like, look, we'll try and get changed somewhat, you know, at the side of the pitch, but certainly going to the bathroom as a woman in the bushes just doesn't really work. And you have to take into consideration like periods and menstrual cycle and that kind of thing. And if you don't have toilet facilities available for girls and women to use, like, absolutely, is that going to put them off participating in sport? Like, if you have it, if you know what your own club is like and that those facilities are available, you know what you're walking into. But if you're in a sport where you have to travel from one club to another club to another club and you don't know what you're walking into, like, do you mind being an adult woman that's not comfortable with that? Like, but put yourself into the shoes of a 13 or 14 year old. Yeah. You know, they've had 3 or 4 periods and they're trying to figure that out. Like, that's just not a comfortable position. So we have to keep having that conversation until there is supports put in place for clubs to develop. I think bathrooms is the first one and then changing rooms come second. But like, I have met coaches that are, you know, still playing, you know, football and stuff themselves, like love the sport, but then they feel a little bit of a fraud sometimes when they're bringing, you know, their under 15s girls to go and play a match and they have to stop off in the town to go into the local pub to, you know, send all the girls in to, you know, go to the bathroom and stuff and to get changed and that.
Or the petrol station just around the corner.
Yeah, exactly. Whoever will let them in to use the bathrooms, essentially. But like, what about the girl that has her period and then at halftime is freaking out because she's afraid that there's going to be blood in her shorts or running down her leg and all that kind of stuff. So, we have thankfully squared away a bit more resource to be able to do that. We've always been doing it in some capacity, but it really we need to have like a focused effort to be able to do those things. So, one example of, I suppose, some of the lobbying stuff that we've done.
What are the major differences between starting a social enterprise and another enterprise? And what is... Like, because I've had lots of charities on, and ultimately you go, yeah, charity's great, but there's a business behind the charity that needs to make sure it's working, or else the end game is never achieved.
Look, whatever your legal structure is, like, they all have to be functioning businesses.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's plenty of stories, I suppose, of, you know, maybe looking into non-profit and charity sector, they all have people that have to execute the jobs, goals that they have, and it's money and resource that is going to make those things happen. So in terms of, I suppose, like, we're in it to create social change, like, we're in it for social good, and there has to be, you know, revenue behind that, like, supporting it. There also is like a hugely significant business case in terms of like the, it's a huge growth market. The value of women's sports fans is like 3 times higher than the value of men's sports fans, the expendable income that they're willing to pay, and also their habits are different as well. So it's like learning about that. But, you know, there's very much a business case. Like, you could argue that men's sport is a little bit saturated in terms of some of the opportunities that are there. We're having to get really, really creative, you know, to kind of grow the market. But there's so much opportunity there as well. So I suppose, you know, the ownership and leadership that's there, and the structure that Hersport is at the moment, the social change is really important to us. But could it operate, whether it's the education or whether it's the media side of things, as a business with like less about the social social change? Yeah, it could. Definitely the media side, but that's really what's at the heart of it for us. So we will have you know, our impact targets and revenue targets on an annual basis, and reflect on those, and ensuring, like, if we're taking different actions, it's a little bit, you know, how can it, you know, grow our revenue, or how can it grow our impact? If it doesn't tick one of those boxes, ideally, and they usually, it usually does tick both in some respect, but I suppose how are we different in comparison to like a normal enterprise? There will be decisions that are made that is very much about the impact as opposed to about the commercial.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's the major difference.
You mentioned an interesting point there on the sports fans and things like that. Do you think an awful lot of sports do themselves no favours by not recognising that there's 50% of the population that might be interested in watching their sport? Yeah, and I think of, you know, when I think of the GAA, it's been very, very clever in terms of, like, I just, you know, I've been to a couple of Dublin matches when you see the pink Dublin jerseys and the blue Dublin, and they're obviously not, like, the big issue has always been in the past, you get a jersey, it's a man's jersey, so whether you're a woman or a man, it looks the same. But an awful lot of the sports have cottoned on to this now, and so actually, do you know what? We need merchandise for women, and we need merchandise for men. And as you said, chances are the women are going to spend more on the merchandise anyway. So do you think there's still a lot of sports that haven't, that switch hasn't flicked on in their head?
Yeah, globally. Like, it's this isn't an Ireland only problem. Like, it's certainly globally. I think when it comes to something like merchandise, there's a huge challenge with, you know, being able to get. I think a lot of the women's, you know, fans that are women hate the kind of unisex fit and stuff. They're like, it just doesn't fit us. Like, it doesn't look good. Like, we're not comfortable in it, and those types of things. So, there definitely is that opportunity to connect better with those fans, whether it's in an ideal scenario, if it's an Irish team that's going to, you know, play at a World Cup or, you know, Olympic Games or whatever it might be. You know, ideally, there's just that opportunity for, you know, whatever teams they may be supporting. Ideally, it's both, that there is that option for, you know, both men and women, boys and girls, to feel comfortable in what they're wearing. I think also the experience. So, you know, was speaking to somebody in the last couple of months that was speaking about the women's rugby matches versus the men's rugby matches, and that the consumables were different. So there was a lot more food consumed at, say, a women's Six Nations match than there was at a men's Six Nations match. Less beer, maybe more wine. So it is understanding, like, what are the consumer behaviours, and ensuring, like, that you're not running out of white wine, you know, in the first 15 minutes of the game, or, you know, before the first half is over, whatever that is. You know, women's football, rugby is a lot more family friendly as well. So if there's going to be more kids there, like, what opportunity, like, and it's food, but it's also like entertainment. Think about it from like a long-term fan perspective, and like getting in with those kids and giving them like lifelong memories and building that relationship from a very early age. But also, like, parents spend a lot on their kids. So if it's a very commercial angle, like, there's a lot of stuff that you could do in that respect. So I would say, like, some of the sports that see the biggest differences tend to be the pitch sports, because they operate quite separately. So that tends to be where more of the kind of changes arise, whether that's in terms of like the resources that are invested into the teams, or whether it's actually into the fan behaviour and the fan opportunity and experience. So, you know, are you being put in the Aviva, or is it in Tala, or is it like literally a pitch that, like, you know, there was a story recently enough where, you know, the lights were turned off on the on the club camogie and ladies Gaelic football finals and like that kind of thing. So it's just trying to ensure as we progress that
Yeah, but this isn't rocket science. This just seems like common sense to me. Like, am I missing something?
Look, women's place in society has changed. You know, it has changed in the last 50, 60, 70 years. It's changed in the last 5 and 10 years. So, you know, we have to just decide what we want. And that can be at an individual level, a club level, or a national level. Like, what do government want for women? Acknowledge where you've come from and just try and move the dial forward. Like, it would be like there's a couple of things that you see sometimes when people are trying to move things along. Like, there's a whole thing about like, should professional male athletes and female athletes be paid the same? Mm. I would have a stance on it that if it's coming from national governing bodies and it's state funding, I think they should be paid the same. I do understand if you are running a Manchester United and you are like the fans and everything, like it's a business. Mm-hmm. So that is why the male players are getting paid more than the female players. Doesn't mean that the female players shouldn't be compensated, you know, effectively, and there absolutely should be investment to get them to level to, you know, ensure that that team builds and develops and performs. The more money you put into it, the faster that team is going to, you know, is going to develop. But also invest into it to build the fans and then fill the stadium and see how like that's business. Like it should be trying to fill those stadiums. But it's like the marriage bar was lifted 53 or 54 years ago. Women's sport is still a relatively new concept. Irish international women's rugby is about 32 years old versus the men's is like 118 years older. So there is a bit of acknowledgement of like history in the past, and I suppose not to be naive to think that, you know, just by flicking
the switch. You have professional tennis now in a lot of the majors, the prize money is equivalent in both.
Yeah.
You know, and, so it's, and not, that it's not impossible.
Yeah, but that came from Billie Jean King and, you know, the other group of women that took a stand and forced change and, you know, went up against a couple of people that had completely different perspectives and opinions they did to make that change happen. So, like, you can look at our own doorstep and the change that Katie Taylor had and the influence she had on boxing, both amateur and professional, in terms of looking at the fact that, like, in 2012 was the first time that women's boxing was in the Olympic Games, and she did a display fight. It might have been either earlier in 2012 or in 2011. And they kind of said that the feelings were at the time that it was maybe more mannerly to kind of accept the demonstration fight, and it wasn't expected necessarily that it was going to go through. And then the powers that be thought that it was really entertaining, it was a great fight, so yes, that they would put women's boxing in. Like, we hail her as one of the greatest ever Irish athletes, but forget sometimes actually how, like, she had to break the door down to get women's boxing into the Olympic Games. And then also, like, her fight with Amanda Serrano was the first ever women's fight to headline at Madison Square Gardens, only in the last like 5, 6, 7 years as well. So it takes certain people with maybe the right backing or the stubbornness or whatever it is to actually create change, whether it's in their own sports or whether it's for the wider sports community.
What do you think is the culture that you're trying to create in her sport?
To ensure that there's opportunity there for girls and women, and if they, you know, want to run out and play at Croke Park or want to run out and play at Anfield or whatever it is, you know, compete in Olympic Games, Paralympic Games, that they have those opportunities to do so. If they see themselves, you know, on the sidelines in a coaching position of a Premier League team, that they can do that. If they want to, you know, referee Six Nations match, like there's I think Holly Davison is her name.
Is Scottish referee.
So like, she's,
I wouldn't argue with her, I can tell you that much.
So she's going to be the first female referee to ref an All Blacks game. She's been the first, she's of loads of those types of things. But it's that, you know, when boys and girls are growing up and they see something that they want to be, that the dream is possible to be realised. So I think, you know, kids don't often see gender when they're 5, 6, 7 and watching TV, and, you know, there's lots of girls that, you know, ran around thinking that they could be Ronaldo, but then at a time realised, actually, I won't have that opportunity because I'm a girl and because I'm going to be a woman, etc. So it's just trying to, change that culture. Bring, I suppose, the biggest cohort of people that we need to have conversation with is people that are open-minded. There's obviously people that are already on board, and support them with education and how they can create change in their own, you know, communities or homes or clubs or whatever that is. There's also some people we're never going to convince. Mm. So you can invest a hell of a lot of time in trying to convince
them. You're wasting your time.
Yeah, or focus on kind of the middle group there that, you know, just, again, need a bit of support and education and, like, understanding maybe how, you know, if it's a male athlete that may have had a privileged or more privileged experience than maybe their female counterpart. And, like, there's a lot to be said actually for the male athletes, you know, to show up and to support their female counterparts. So, you know, looking at the international rugby teams, I would see a lot of the female athletes at the men's rugby matches, have yet to see some of the men at the women's matches. Yeah. So yeah, that's an interesting one. Sia Khaleesi is a massive, massive supporter of the South African women's rugby team, as well as just like women's sport generally over there, and is trying to use his platform to create change in South Africa and beyond. And it would be nice to see a little bit more of that kind of support locally. There were conversations during the Women's World Cup. We'd started to see a little bit of dialogue online and had noticed it ourselves, and we have a fans WhatsApp group, and it was noticed that the male players and former male players hadn't really wished the women's team good luck in the World Cup. It was also so close to home, so like it should have been on everyone's radar that it was happening. And then as they kind of gradually got through a couple of the matches, then some more people started to talk about it and wish them luck, but it kind of should have been there from the start, and there should have been more players vocal about it and really rowing behind them, and also realise that, again, the privilege that, you know, maybe the international men's team has had and the exposure they have and how much they can actually help in elevating the women's game. There's a lot that,
because nobody starts out and says I'm a male sports fan or a female sports fan, I'm a sports fan.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. And you have a lot of people that hugely identify with that. I'm a massive sports fan, and then you dig into it and you're like, okay, and
what sports do you watch?
Do you follow, who you know, and start to dive into that conversation, and then you might uncover maybe they're not as much a sports fan as a men's sports fan as they kind of realise and acknowledge themselves.
Has fear of failure ever been a driving force for you?
Has fear of failure ever been a driving force? I don't know. I think as the years have gone on with the business, it's become something I'm maybe more comfortable with. I don't want to fail. Don't get me wrong.
No.
I don't think, like, the industry we're in is very difficult. Mm-hmm. So, like, it is a growth market, it is progressing, but if, you know, there are another recession or something happens, or, you know, something like COVID, marketing budgets tend to be the ones that get cut
very quickly.
Diversity, equality and inclusion budgets, like, there has been an impact, you know, on those budgets based on, like, what's been happening in the States and that kind of thing. So, like, we fit into that bracket as well. So, you know, and, like, you know, we've been eligible for some grants, but you start to grow out of the grant opportunities as well. And now the nonprofit side should help with that. But when we were in the infancy of the business, there were some grants we were eligible for, and then you become ineligible for them after a couple of years. So, yeah, you have to look, I suppose, around at the risks as well, or what the threats are. And, like, I think there's so much opportunity for the business, but if something didn't quite go to plan, or there was some, as I said, COVID-like event or something, I think we have to be very proud with, like, what we have achieved and the impact that we've had. And, you know, as I said, like, we nearly have, you know, we're heading towards 500,000 people following us across the different social platforms. We have influenced the National Women and Girls Strategy. We've been involved. We're asked for recommendations on inclusion in sport from the Oireachtas. There's a lot of, like, we know that we have influenced other media outlets to cover more women's sport and that as well. So, like, we have to be very proud of, like, what we have accomplished. Like, also, like, we've employed a variety of different people over the years and supported them and their families and all that kind of thing. So we're absolutely trying our best. I don't think there's going to be a failure. Like we have never, like, I spoke to my business partner about it in this year, and I was like, you know, has there ever been any major mistake that we've made? And we couldn't really come up with a good one. You know,
don't maybe, jinx yourself now.
Maybe, you know, you spent, you know, a couple of €1,000 on, you know, he says the training diaries that we bought, that maybe we bought too many of them. But, like, it's not it's not a big mistake. I would argue they're non-perishable goods, so they'll sell eventually.
Everybody along with the pen and paper.
And look, that's like the reason that something like that hasn't moved is because we don't give that the time because we're so focused on the other side of the business. So that's a long convoluted conversation, I'm sure. But yeah, I think like we're putting a lot of effort and energy and trying to support the business with as much experience as possible as well. Like, we developed a board of advisors just over a year ago as well. So it's not something I believe will happen, but I've also become comfortable with saying like, we have done our best, we've accomplished all of these different things. If for some reason, like for us, the threat is like, what if, you know, there's some of the American companies start coming over and competing with us or whatever. Like, there's loads of different things that could happen. But yeah, so I'm not comfortable with it, but I'm not uncomfortable with it either.
And then how do you deal with setbacks?
Try and be rational and logical about the situation. They're going to happen. And then just keep believing that we've done the work, that the next opportunity is going to come. You know, if there is a setback, maybe it's a partnership that is, you know, not progressing into the next year, or a reduction in funding or whatever that looks like. Or, you know, we've changed personnel on, you know, at different times and stuff as well. Like, you have to be able to kind of step back from it. What's the impact and how can you solve the problem? You know, what the business looks like now, it may not always look like as well. So to be adaptable, I suppose that's something, you know, we're still a small team. There's a lot of stuff that we can do as well. Like, the business is called Her Sport. That doesn't specifically tell you what we do. So, you know, we have education, we have merchandise, we have the media side, you know, we hold events. Like, there's loads of different things we could do. So I think it's a privilege not to be limited in what the possibilities are, and to have that flexibility as well. So, yeah, don't be too thrown by them, and just figure out the next steps if you can.
Learn from them and move on.
Yeah, definitely try and learn from the difference.
If you could have one brand ambassador right now for the business, who would it be and why?
One brand ambassador right now. If it's global, probably Ilona Maher.
Okay.
So she is an American rugby player. Started off playing in sevens, then went into 15s. Played at the World Cup, won an Olympic medal in sevens in the Paris Olympics. She's the most followed rugby player, male or female, online. And she very much aligns with what we do and what we stand for. Very body positive. Gets criticised actually for the amount of time that she spends like building her brand and, you know, doing branded partnerships and, you know, creating content online. And then she will turn around and say, well, my sport doesn't pay me enough to have, like, to sustain the lifestyle that I want to have. It's not necessarily going to give her this, you know, great pension. And I mean, athletes' pensions have to come sooner than most people's, don't they? And depending on when someone has obviously gone into a sports career, have they done education? Have they got work experience? Like, those questions obviously arise. So I think she very much gets it and is doing some really, really great work in that space. So yeah, she's on the list of people to meet and to do something with at some point. So yeah, we may have to just take a trip over to the States, but there's lots of local people as well that I think would be great. Like, I think Katie Taylor and Katie McCabe as well, like, with, I suppose, what they talk about. Like, Katie Taylor, I suppose, a little quieter about it by nature, but has done so much, and it's so important to her to pave the way for young women, and not just in boxing but in sport. And then I suppose Katie McCabe is a little bit more vocal about it on a regular basis because she just does more media than Katie Taylor tends to. And I think the legacy that both of those athletes will leave behind is great.
I suppose as you go through and as you become more successful, there's always a risk with companies that you get distracted and you start branching into stuff that you shouldn't really. It's not that you shouldn't really, but it's just, you know, you're not kind of knowing in your heart that it's not going to work out. So how do you not lose focus or intensity in what the core mission is?
Yeah, there's a bit of a reset and an evaluation every year. And honestly, it has to probably happen a couple of times during the year as well, doesn't it? Like, we just have to, you know, stay true to that kind of what are our goals? So it's the impact, and then it's the generating revenue. The more we can do of both, the more success we can have. And I think they're, you know, questioning yourself sometimes is like, why am I doing this? Like, why have I done this task or taken that meeting or whatever it is? Like, what's the impact? And yeah, just making sure you don't get too distracted by the shiny things and stuff too. As I said, like, there's loads of opportunities for us, and we have had all these weird and wonderful and all big and small ideas, like anything in between. So it's just trying to make sure that we're focusing on the things that work for us, doing them to the best of our ability, ensuring we're not getting distracted so that we reduce our quality, that we're always looking to increase our quality and be better and improve all the time. And then you're gonna try things, and some of them will fail. And I suppose if you don't try them, you won't know. And take the learnings out of them if you can. I mean, if you can tweak it and it works, great. Or if it has to be binned, so be it. So yeah, it is. I suppose the more a team grows as well, the more ideas and concepts and directions that people want to go. So it can be a little bit of like, okay, we'll refocus, and these are the core goals. Whether it's for a month, a quarter, a year. Or long term.
Do you obsess about the small things?
Yes and no. There's some stuff like that will really irk me if it's just like, I'm just like, have we made that mistake again? And if it's like, we do a lot of content, so branding is, you know, important to us. And sometimes people might, like, you know, on the team might fiddle with the size of the logo on the content, and I'm like, this is standard. We have a brand guidelines. Like, why has this logo now ended up, like, you know, not in the same place that it usually is? Or, you know, I've seen people maybe change the transparency of it, and like that kind of stuff. Like, can we just please stick to what was agreed?
There's a template, just fill in the template.
Exactly. And I know it can be hard to make all the things work all the time, but it is like, they're the kind of things that I'm like, okay, we agreed, and there's a reason as to why. But then also at the same time, like, not to be too obsessive over something like that, because I should be worried about things that are a lot bigger than that. How many people are really going to scroll through our content and realize that one of the logos is like 75% of the others? Like, not very many. So it is trying to instill a class and a quality in what we do. A standard and expectation is like very important, but then also ensuring that you're focusing on, you know, the right things. So like, we would have done some training last year, myself and Mohammed, and, you know, it's talking about like, what are your high payoff items, like what are the tasks that you're supposed to be focusing on. So it's trying to ensure not to get too distracted. Back to your distraction point, maybe on some of those things. So trying to, I suppose, as the team has gone from two people up to kind of eight with the extension of our board and other people that come on at different times, to realise like, you have to let go control of some of the things, and to be comfortable in how somebody else will make a decision. I may not agree with it, or I may have gone from a different approach, but if you worded it that way, that's okay. Yeah. Or if you think that's the right plan, okay, we're going to just, like, otherwise you're never going to get all the things that you want to get done.
No, definitely not. Social media, traditional media?
From what perspective?
Well, in terms of impact now, and impact for the company, which is more important?
I mean, impact for us is social media. I mean, it's our whole business. So you can, if social media didn't exist, like, we wouldn't exist. And so expensive to run a traditional media company. And if we wanted to do a magazine or a newspaper or any of that, like, it would have been a huge outlay of cash to do it, and a huge risk. And also probably not get in front of the audience that wants to connect with us. Like, it's a an audience that's very comfortable online, so that's why we went the route that we did. In terms of making impact for women's sport, at the moment, I think the powers that are making the most influence is digital media. So I suppose that goes from, like, when you look at social media, like, YouTube is encapsulated in that as well. Was just speaking about how, they have kind of free to air Women's Super League and a couple of other competitions, and the influence and impact that can have. Traditional media definitely has its place. Some of them, I'm not sure whether they'll survive. I don't know if you can listen to a couple of experts in the industry. I don't think television is going to be gone soon. It might be different. It might be more digital television. Like, we obviously have all the streaming platforms. Will traditional broadcasting remain? who knows? But yeah, for us, it's definitely your social media and digital media that's impact for us and also for women's sport.
You mentioned earlier on about in terms of the obsessed about small things and the size of the font and different things like that. But how do you deal with
kind of, wrong?
No. It's more. How do you deal with PR headaches or mishaps? You know that you know, and we see it all the times. Whether it's stuff somebody that's associated with the company, something happens to them, or you know, like there's a long history of it. What would your approach be to dealing with that PR headache?
Yeah, I'm trying to think if we ever come across anything. Like
I'm
major,
to
yeah. But whether it's that or whether it's indirectly related, because like sometimes if one female athlete or team does something, it reflects on all of the female athletes and teams, and they may not be like associated with them at all. And you know what someone might say about the women's sports industry can feed into a different direction. So I suppose it's maybe less about us, and what I would see is maybe the damage that people can do to the growth of women's sport, and that can be. People that are passionate about it and not passionate about people that actually actively want to damage the opportunity. But I suppose from our side, it is probably trying to be like upfront and honest about like if there are, you know, mistakes that are made, and you know, you take the learnings out of things. Like anything that we would ever do is like never intentional. It, you know, if there was a, I suppose what you're saying from like a PR perspective, it might be a not having all of the information to hand or something like that, and just handling it as best possible as you can. Yeah, it's that kind of stuff. Like, and like we have a huge community, so you have to be, you have to treat them fairly and treat them properly. And if you do make a mistake, own up to it.
Fess up and move on.
Yeah.
Who do you or who have you sought advice from in the business context?
Yeah, it's ranged over the years. Like we've spoken to people in the media space, we've, you know, spoken to entrepreneurs that might have nothing to do with like our business, but it's like a lot of the challenges that you know, business owners experience are similar. So, you know, you step back and there are stories to compare. We've been on programs that have been great. So have been part of Social Entrepreneurs Ireland, a program with them. So it was good to actually be in the social enterprise space and get support from peers, but also from the experts and the team that they have in that organization. I've also been part of the Going for Growth program as well. So would have had Marissa Carter leading the group that I was part of, and then also learned from other businesses. Again, more kind of peer support because there was kind of 10 of us at the table, but also you got exposed to more people in the community and that as well. Our board have been great, and while the board was only formed maybe 18 months ago, some of those people have been kind of advisors in the background actually probably since like 2020, 2021. And then definitely, I suppose, from a family perspective, like trying to, you know, my dad's business is totally different. But again, like back to some of the challenges.
Business at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. So like what have, you know, they done or what have they learned? And, you know, yeah, it is a very different business, but some of the issues are the same. And he doesn't always have the answers, but you can ask the question, can't you?
Yeah, absolutely. What do you think is the hardest part of the job as a CEO?
I think one of the biggest challenges is like creating the right team. I think with that, like for us anyway, some of the experience in what we're looking for isn't specifically there. So like if women's sport is a new industry, there's not lots of women's sports experts as an example out there. So they have to come into us to be trained by us. So that like that takes time and resource obviously to train people up and to develop. It'll be much easier in 10 years time when all the Her Sport fans are able to walk into journalism roles and become content creators and all that kind of stuff because we've kind of created them. But yeah, I think putting like the right like team around you and, you know, ensuring that everyone's on the same page around the vision and the mission and the why, and then has the understanding of the brand guidelines and all those other important things as well. But yeah, I think that is, like, it's such an important part of any business is having the right people and the right culture. but it has its challenges, and obviously like getting it right. So ensuring like people on the team are complementing each other, ensuring that we as like, you know, leaders have the right time to support people as they develop and to give people the right information and all those things so they can do their job to the best of their ability, and then also like develop and that kind of thing as well. So like we are like even hiring, like we've been trying to hire for a couple of positions this year and like found that challenging from like two fronts. It's like trying to find the people and the talent that we're looking for, but actually it takes a savage amount of time to do all the interviews and go through all the rounds and like all that kind of thing. So this year is the first year that we all have worked with a recruitment company to support us in that, because we actually just can't afford the time it takes us away from the team and the business. So yeah, hiring for a couple of senior roles at the moment that hopefully we'll be able to develop out some different areas of the business. But it's tough. Like it's hard to strike a balance with all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you hate losing or love winning?
Probably hate losing, I think. Yeah, probably that.
I hate losing more than them.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of me. Yeah, like I can see it in sport and I can see it in business. Like if we were, you know, pitching to a client and somebody else got the opportunity, like you can feel the frustration about that. And particularly if you feel like you're a much better fit, but then you also have to be able to lose graciously as well and say, look, that just didn't work out this time, and what's the next opportunity for us? So you have to have that maturity. And you know, when we're doing the educational workshops,
it's still like, not nice,
yeah, no, it's not. And like what I would say to the kids is like, look, you're going to lose a lot of times in life, more than you're ever going to win. So, you know, I suppose I've lost a lot of races in my sporting career. So you have to be able to take that. But yeah, I suppose, look, I've the second sport I did that, I suppose we would have taken quite seriously, like there's only a medal for first, so you have to get used to losing. And I suppose when you do win, it can be quite a sweet victory as well.
Fast or slow decision making?
It has to be somewhere in the middle, like honestly. Like there's something to be said to, you know, for being able to make a decision and you know, move on, and not being paralyzed by information and you know, overthinking something on the other end of the spectrum. But it probably depends what it is. Like some stuff, like, you know, we can't, you know, hyperanalyze some, you know, some of the smaller things. But then, you know, there are things that do need the due consideration and need to put that kind of time into it. So, yeah, it depends. But it's probably...
And then in similar ways, when it comes to making decisions, are you data-based or gut feel?
Also probably a bit of both. I'm probably naturally a bit more gut feel.
Yeah.
But trying to train myself to be more, God, am I? Because I like really did like maths and stuff in school. So I will sometimes pull up the numbers on different things. I'll always have rationale behind a reason. So if somebody has a different perspective to me, I will always have a logic as to why.
So there's some database, has to be
back. There's a couple of proof points, but it might not all gut feel, but I suppose it's on like learned experience and that kind of thing as well. But I suppose when it comes to like if someone's really not, he has a completely different perspective to you, I think you have to go back to the data and say, because like you can also think like when it comes to sometimes campaigns that we do with clients, so you know, we do a lot of coverage in the rugby league here, and you know, we might think that a player profile performs better than like our weekly roundup, but then if you go and look at the numbers, it might actually be the other way around. Right. So sometimes you have to, like, you can have this, like as you said, gut feel, but you might be wrong. So I think there is a value to both. It's all very diplomatic, isn't it?
Yeah,
well, somewhere in the middle of everything.
It always is, trust me. There's no right or wrong answers. What do the next 5 years look like for Hersport?
As I said, I suppose with the team, hopefully bringing in a couple of senior people that can support us in developing out the different areas of the business that we want to. So definitely on that like media partnership side, to build and grow that, like feel like there's a lot more we can do in Ireland, but also a lot of opportunity in the UK, and to ensure that we invest into that to, you know, realise the dream that we have. And then also with education, like there's again so much opportunity with it, but we don't always get the time to resource it in the way that we'd like to. So we do a lot of workshops in schools, in clubs, and a lot of speaking engagements in business for like International Women's Day or other events that might come up. So like, again, we have a lot of dreams with that and what that could look like, but we need the right people, particularly in that area. Like, we can continue to do what we're doing, but to build and grow in the way that we'd like to, we need more support there. So I suppose they're the kind of two key things that we have ambition for. We've just expanded our space as well, so hopefully kind of going to build and develop that out a little bit. Yeah, more in the team. And yeah, just like, there's a couple of quirky things we'd like to have the options to do. So we would like those options of like a basketball hoop on the wall and maybe the Wii in the corner and all that kind of stuff. It's like, you want to demonstrate people's personalities, like when you meet them. And, you know, athletes can get boxed in a bit as well. So how can we, you know, bring them out of their shell? And I know the basketball hoop mightn't bring the basketball players out, but it might bring some of the swimmers out.
Doing something different.
But yeah, I know there's, I think, so much that we want to do. It's just getting the right resource and the right partnerships and stuff behind us to do those things. And I suppose lastly is like Array and the Her Sport Foundation to be able to do the work that we want there. So one of the pillars that we have in the foundation is education. So supporting schools that maybe don't have the financial resources to have us in, we have a pot of money there to ensure we can go out to them. The lobbying part and the advocacy part comes into it as well. So to try and keep working on those things and move the dial. We also want to be able to support athletes and teams with grants and equipment, and like, we get so many requests for support there, so to be able to distribute that and yeah, the foundation has a lot of opportunities as well. But yeah, who thought we'd be running two businesses? We thought we were just going to start with one.
Well, you see, if you want something done, give it to a busy person, they always say. What advice would you give to young people about careers, about life, about anything?
Yeah, I think one of the things that like I usually would speak to is like, the worst someone can say to you is no, or like, I suppose it's back to the losing. Like, if you don't put your name in the hat, like, it's definitely not going to be pulled out. So I think putting yourself forward for opportunities, they may not always be comfortable, or, you know, maybe you don't think you're the right person for the job, but, you know, if you don't apply, you're certainly not going to get it. But equally, you're not going to get the learnings out of it as well. So, like, you know, going for
interviews.
Stay
involved. That's the key.
Yeah. Like going for interviews, like, you're going to learn something about yourself. And again, it may not be comfortable. Yeah. You mightn't enjoy it, but you will gain something from it. So I think it is, putting yourself forward, you know, going for those opportunities, backing yourself and believing that you learn and gain something from it. So, yeah, that's one of the things.
Right. Black book is out.
Okay.
We'll wait and see what we've got.
I feel pressure to put a question in the book.
Well, you won't be the first person to say that. All right. What is the source of your intrinsic motivation? What gets you back up every time you get knocked back?
Okay. I think it's understanding the impact and the differences that like I as one person can make, and you know, you have to be a bit reflective sometimes and, you know, say has made, like, we are in, like, our business is all about doing social good and creating social impact. So like, wow, is that a brilliant thing to have as a driver? Not every business has that. You know, if they do find, you know, sometimes they mightn't want to get out of bed. Like, it's thinking about, you know,
well, it's that idea that money can't be the only ever motivator.
Yeah, it is,
you know, and you have something very tangible that isn't
exactly
money.
And I think, like, when we go out to, like, I've done a couple more club workshops recently than I have done for a while. I tend to be very busy at the start of the year, and then just as the cards have kind of fallen, like, I've been supporting the team with doing a couple of the club workshops recently, and it's actually really nice to go out and do them, and probably should put myself forward for doing like one every 2 months, because when you're standing in a classroom or in a sports club with people that you know, where you can, if someone's sitting on the fence about staying in sport or not, that you can tip them over to stay involved in sport, or if you hear the challenges that they're facing and you can give them the advice and the confidence
quite energizing
to stay involved. Yeah, exactly. And like, I mean, yeah, some of them are just so excited. And like even did an adult group last week, and to hear the challenges they face, but also the growth that they've seen and the opportunities and the influence that they're trying to have in their own club as well. So like that's all very motivating. But yeah, you have to put yourself in those rooms as well. So whether it's going to industry events and like all of that kind of thing. But yeah, the impact, like one of the other things that like I don't have the time to do it, but I would see, like we tie a lot into like women in leadership. So 94% of women in executive managerial positions have a background in sport. There's obviously a lot of conversation around women at C-suite level and like the gender balance, gender pay gap, gender pension gap, like a lot around that. And I like do have a bone to pick with the government around like the structure of like maternity leave and paternity leave. And one of the things in the Girls and Women's strategy was that parental leave, it's either parents leave or parental leave, is like equal access for all parents. But I think like that's great, and it's great that there's an extension and all of that, like to support having families and that. But the impact that offering, you know, the mom who bears a child, you know, 6 months paid maternity leave and then the unpaid maternity leave, and how that can impact, you know, her career versus either, you know, their female partner that hasn't taken that change or a dad. I think like a lot of work needs to be done around that space. So I try and speak to as many people about it as possible, but it's not like, you know, there's a couple of people that can certainly move that along more than I can. But yeah, that's just, you know, the casual conversation.
Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Niamh Tallon. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks, and we will see you next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.